I am so aware that I can do this because I know very acutely what it feels like to not be able to do it.
Welcome to the Shakeout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Van Buskirk. In 2009, Lisa Sweetman was training for her first half marathon when she started noticing disturbing changes in her body. In the decade that has proceeded, she's undergone life-threatening surgeries, remarkable recoveries, and a total shift in perspective. This month's issue of Canadian Running Magazine is all about inspiration, and today's episode could not do a better job of encapsulating that theme. But before we get into that, staff writer Maddie Kelly and I bring you the latest news and results from the wonderful world of running. This is The Rundown.
Happy Friday, Maddie.
Oh my God. Thanks, Kate. Living my best life on a Friday.
Living your best Friday.
No, I don't really like that saying, living my best life.
Okay.
I actually can't.
Living your life on a Friday.
Living my life on a Friday. I can't even articulate why I don't like it. Probably just because it's everywhere.
It's too mainstream.
I think that, but I'm not even that alternative. You know what? I'm gonna have to think about this on my own time.
Okay, no worries. Report back to us, please.
I will.
I'm very curious to hear your personal opinion on living your best life.
Yeah, I'm gonna come up with my own version.
Okay, I respect that.
Please stay tuned.
Whatever it's called, I feel like you're doing it. So way to go.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You got back a little under a week ago from sunny California.
Yes, I did.
Tell us about it.
It was a blast. It was such a last minute decision.
And why were you there?
I was there to race. I raced a 1500, which isn't something I typically do.
No.
It is a weird distance. It's long, super weird. It's so long. And it's different than the 8 because you don't like stop moving the way you do in the last 30 meters of an 8, but you just can't go faster. There wasn't any more to give. I didn't need to stop running. I could keep going at the pace I was.
Right.
But
there was just no more acceleration left.
There was no more acceleration. In fact, a deceleration was happening, but just not at the rate of an 800.
Okay, not quite as ugly.
Exactly. Anyway, you know, interesting, fun event. I think I'm going to start running more than one annually.
Excellent.
So I can actually get good at them, maybe.
Well, you did run a PB in the 1500 Brian Clay Invitational.
Yeah, it was a PB, but when you run one a year, as long as like you haven't taken a year off and eaten hamburgers, you improve.
You know what, Maddie? A PB is a PB. So congratulations to you.
Appreciate it. Also, that was no shade to hamburgers. I'm a big fan and I eat them year round.
Yeah,
but good. I continue to run while I eat the hamburger.
Fair. It's all about balance. So let's run down some more of the exciting Canadian results from that Brian Clay Invitational.
I will start with Lindsay Butterworth because she was in my heat and I chased her. And her 4:11 is very impressive from that race. There were 16 girls on the track. She had to do a lot of moving. She was in last for at least 400 meters of that race. So considering the condition she ran in, a 4:11 is actually probably more like a 4:08 or a 4:09. That was not an easy way to run a 4:11. So kudos to Lindsay. She's in very good shape.
Nice.
Rory Linkletter ran a 13:36 5,000 meter. And fun fact, he wrote his last exam today, and he's the first person from his family to graduate from college.
That is so exciting. I love those stories.
Very cool.
Way to go, Rory.
Yeah, you just raised the bar for your entire family.
He's living his best life. I don't care. I'm saying it.
That's fine. I just won't.
All right.
You know what? I might have changed my stance by the end of this conversation.
Rory might have changed your mind. And then our final top Canadian performer at that Brian Clay invite, we got to talk about Georgia Ellenwood.
Georgia Ellenwood.
Heptathlete.
61:35. A great score. First place in the meet. And really getting her 2019 outdoor season off to a great start. And her first year as a professional athlete.
Professional athlete. Starting it off with a bang. Good job, Georgia. Mm-hmm. So there was another pretty high profile track meet in California last weekend. It was the Mount SAC relays, which, don't be mistaken, they are not just relays. There's lots of distance running that happens there. Mm-hmm. Walk us through it, Maddie.
Farah Abdul-Karim of Ottawa ran a 10,000. And he ran a huge PB of 28:39.
Yeah, that was, a 3-minute personal best? That's unreal.
And his story, like, it's interesting because he wasn't a standout in high school. He went to a pretty small college. He left that college. He kind of emailed Ole Miss on a whim to be like, would you take me? Assumed he would never hear from him. They got back to him first out of all the schools he emailed. And then now he's there running, and he's had these huge PBs. He's made the FISU standard. It's looking like he's going to make the FISU team.
Amazing.
So super exciting for him. He's clearly made a lot of really good decisions that have brought him to this point.
Incredible.
And then Django Lovett won the high jump at Mount SAC with a jump of 230, and Mike Mason was second with a jump of 224.
So our male high jumpers are kind of on fire right now. I mean, that quite honestly was maybe a little bit of a disappointment for Mike, but he did just come off that incredible 231 a couple of weeks ago. He is clearly in the shape of his life. That was, you know, 2 centimeters away from his PB. And, you know, Derek Druin's coming back into the four. We've got Django Lovett kicking ass, taking names. Mm-hmm. So
more competitive than it's been in a long time.
Totally.
But that's in so many distances now. Like I was even saying this year, Canadian champs, it used to be that in events you would have like this one token person and it was like, well, duh, they're gonna win, and they would just run away. But I think this year we're actually gonna see some real races at champs and at national, sorry, instead of just like one person getting to the line, everyone being terrified of them controlling the race. It's over. That's not fun to watch.
Nope.
But the good news is that's not really the case anymore.
Nope. Everyone's stepping up their game. Mm-hmm. And you know, we do tend to see this as we approach the Olympic year, right? Like people come out of the woodwork a little bit. Anyway, it ups everyone's game. We've talked about this phenomenon before. Love to see it. So moving on to our third major track meet of the weekend, it was the LSU Alumni Gold Meet. We had our sprinters there, and my goodness, did they perform well. Our men's 4x1 came third in 38.88. Unfortunately, our women's 4x1, they did race well, but they were disqualified for a lane violation. But both of those teams will be going on to the World Relay Championships in two weeks.
In 2 weeks.
But I would say probably the performer of that meet was a solo event. Miss Maddie Price, and I got to give her a shout out because she's a Duke alum just like me, ran a 51.66 in the 400. Mm-hmm. Which is unbelievably fast. She won the event. She was super close to the Olympic standard of 51.35. This girl is on fire.
That's a huge time. That would be one of the fastest Canadian all time.
Absolutely. Yeah, we should actually stay tuned. We'll bring you an update on where Maddie Price sits on the Canadian all time list, but it's up there.
It's
for
high.
Sure. Yeah. So again, speaking about those world relays, Canada did announce that they will be sending 4 teams, a women's and men's 4x1, and women and men's 4x4. Moving on to some not so positive news, why don't you tell us what juicy information we got out of the world of track doping?
So, Asbel Kiprop, 2008 Olympic gold medalist in the 1500 meter, has tested positive for EPO. He continues to deny the use. He says that he has naturally high red blood cells due to training at altitude, which is a difficult theory to wrap your head around because so many people do that.
I was going to say, he's clearly not the first or the only person to have trained and exerted themselves to the level that he has at altitude. You know, this is why we do things like blood passports, which is where every time you make a national team, it's now required for every athlete to provide a preemptive sample so that there can be a database where athletes can be tracked to see if their levels of various hormones, you know, naturally occurring substances change throughout their career. You know, we're at a point where the anti-doping system is pretty sophisticated. It sounds like he kind of threw out some Hail Marys. He tried to blame 4 different reasons for why he might have had elevated EPO levels. None of them really held up. He's now serving a 4-year ban starting back in February of 2018. It was an exciting last weekend of track racing, but Maddie, we've got both track and, more excitedly, big road races this weekend.
This weekend, there's a ton going on. We have the Penn Relays. We have the Drake Relays. There will be a bunch of Canadians at both of those events. And there's almost always a big result that comes out of at least one of these events.
Yeah, totally.
Someone really does something impressive.
And it's a fun team event, too. If you're in college, you know, I used to do this as a Dukie all the time. We'd go, and it sort of seems like teams either go to Drake or Penn, but it is such a great atmosphere, and it's fun to just totally be focused on your team and not, you know, doing too much individual stuff.
And they both have big high school races too, which is really exciting for the up-and-comers.
Totally. Great atmosphere. All right, but roads. I think this is where the real story is going to be. Maddie, what do we have going on the roads this weekend?
Canadian international story is Trevor Hofbauer. He's heading to Hamburg racing on Sunday. So if you're watching the London Marathon, do not forget to check the Hamburg results because Trevor's looking for a big one there. Unfortunately, Reed Coolsett was supposed to race as well. He's dealing with a bit of an injury. Hasn't totally sidelined his season, but he wasn't going to be ready for Hamburg. So right. He is going to get back to us with when his next marathon will be. He's not done for the season. It just won't be Hamburg.
Just taking a break. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And then, like I just said, the London Marathon is also happening this Sunday. Insane women's field. Bonkers.
I believe, Maddie, you recently wrote a headline saying it was arguably the deepest women's field at a marathon ever.
I don't even want to have the arguably in there. I think it just is.
You're definitive. I like that.
Of the fastest female marathon performances ever, we have in the top 10, 6 of those women running London.
Jeez Louise.
It's insane. We have 5 world major marathon winners. We have the women's only world record holder. And then the second storyline are the two Americans, Emily Sisson, who's debuting, and Molly Huddle, who debuted in a 2:26 at New York, which is insane.
Spicy. Insane.
So these are two very, very anticipated races. And I think that Emily Sisson's debut could be one of the fastest American debuts ever seen. Could rival Jordan Hesse's.
That would be incredible. And we do know that, of course, Emily and Molly are training partners. They actually, Emily beat Molly in that crazy fast 10K a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. where they both got standard and cracked, what, the top 5 all-time American list? Yeah. Like, it was, they were rolling.
And she ran within 5 seconds of Huddle's American half marathon record at Houston.
Right. Wow, that's going to be a very exciting and spicy race.
Very exciting. And not to forget what's going on in Canada, we have the Montreal Half Marathon this Sunday, and that'll feature Tristan Woodvine and Yves Sikuwabu.
Excellent. We also have Rachel Hanna and Anne-Marie Como on the women's side. Yeah, set up to be a really exciting race. Tons of things to keep track of this weekend. Do not forget to hit us up at runningmagazine.ca. We will be giving you updates. We will be giving you results. We will be bringing you all the excitement from around the world, as always.
And final little tidbit about London. Watch the water. Watch at the water stops what people are drinking, because they're edible. They are doing away with single-use disposable cups, and instead they're like these little water droplets that you bite into, and the packaging is made from seaweed. It's entirely biodegradable and digestible.
Okay, so Earth Day was earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
Totally self-proclaimed environmentalist.
Yeah.
I love the concept of this.
Yeah.
Very curious how it's going to work in actual execution. I'm not certain that I would love chomping into something filled with water.
Chomping into water?
Basically.
Yeah, I know. People say it works, though. This isn't the first marathon they've used it at. They've used
it
at a couple of their halves in the UK. Eating water sounds hard.
Eating water does sound hard.
Eating water sounds hard mid-marathon. But we'll see. I'm sure people will let us know on Twitter how it went.
Please do.
People
Please.
Love airing grievances on Twitter.
They do, and we're here for it. Finally, in the world of the trails, there was one result that we neglected to mention last week around the Boston Marathon, and that was the fact that the top Canadian male finisher at Boston is actually a trail runner.
Trail runners running on the roads, road runners running on the trail, they go hand in hand, folks.
They do.
The two worlds do not need to be separate.
No. Carl Ogston ran 2:25:30, which is a remarkable time. Mainly because his goal time was 2:25 if it was a perfect day. And we know from all accounts that, especially if you're a Canadian that's used to training in the harsh winters, mm-hmm. believe he trains out of Canmore, he's used to having some crappy weather to train in the winter. It was hot and humid, and he came within 30 seconds of his goal time.
Super impressive.
Very impressive. Now, he did say that although he was really proud of his Boston performance, he does see trail running and road running as completely different sports. We just talked about how much they complement each other, but, you know, to each their own.
We're just saying you can do both.
Right.
You can do both at the same time.
This means you can call yourself a multi-sport athlete.
totally true.
Very exciting.
That's got a nice ring to it, right?
It does.
Trail runner, road runner. Yeah. Multi-sport.
Love it. So he'll be moving back onto the trails for the foreseeable future, but congratulations, Carl.
In other trail news, UTMB announced this week that it is making changes to its qualification process over the next 2 years. The main reason for this is that the event has seen an enormous increase in participant numbers over the past few years, and the organizers are trying to make the entry process more flexible, creating a dual system where you have on one hand the lottery and on the other hand points accumulation.
Right.
To learn more about this and all of our other Canadian trail news, visit the Trail Running tab on the Canadian Running website and check out all of the great content by our trail editor, Tori Schultz.
Yeah, Tori. This has been your rundown for this week. Thanks for joining me, Maddie.
No problem, Kate.
We'll talk soon.
So my name's Lisa Sweetman, and I own a food business called Earth and City, which was established partway through my teaching journey. So I started as an elementary school teacher. I did my master's at U of T in child study and education. Became a teacher, had been teaching for about 5 years, and then found myself on a healing journey and started eating a different way and came up with this company with a new friend. I'm now a teacher again and still have Earth and City, and I'm the mother of a 2-year-old boy and a wife to my great partner, Ashley.
Lisa is a woman of diverse interests and accomplishments. Business owner, teacher, runner, mother. But there's another aspect of her life that has shaped her immensely and in many ways set the stage for the thirst for life that she has today. It all began with the end of one relationship and the start of another relationship with running.
In 2008, I had a bad breakup and a friend gave me Runner's World half marathon issue. And she said, "I don't know what to tell you. You're going through this painful process. I have this Runner's World magazine." And she gave it to me, and I decided that I would follow the 16-week half marathon training plan as a way of coping. And so I started running and used that as the way to kind of get through that summer. Took this half marathon as an opportunity to get my head out of what I was going through and into my body.
Lisa fell in love with running and took to her training plan with great dedication. But within a few months, she started noticing changes in her body that she wasn't expecting.
I stopped menstruating and a couple of doctors were like, "Oh, well, you're running a lot." And I said, "No, I'm running a half marathon. This is not amenorrhea from, you know, athleticism." And I knew very well that it wasn't what was going on. And my skin was really rough and I started gaining weight, which seemed very counter to what was happening in my fitness life.
Over the next several months, Lisa's symptoms got progressively worse. Her joints ached. Her skin got coarser. She continued gaining weight. She sought medical advice in as many places as she could, but each visit to a new doctor left her with more unanswered questions.
I would go to doctors, they would test for various things like rheumatoid arthritis, and it would come back as not that. And they would think that maybe there was a blood issue and it would come back as not that. And so I was perpetually seeing different doctors and nobody was coming to any conclusions. And the thing that I learned really quickly was I was going to need to be an advocate for myself because nobody else was going to do it. And so I continued to say over and over to whoever would listen to me that something is not right. Because eventually they start to sort of say, maybe your body's just adjusting, or your hormones are a little out of balance, you know, wait and see kind of thing. And so I continued to articulate that this wasn't normal. Throughout this whole period of time in my life, I referred to it as the otherwise healthy phase, because every doctor I would ream off all these things that were wrong with me. And then they would say to me, "Okay, but you're otherwise healthy." And I would say, "I don't understand what you think health is, but saying otherwise healthy makes no sense to me." So all of my friends and family know otherwise healthy as a thing. Because basically, if you don't have heart disease or diabetes or something, then you're healthy. Every doctor I would sit there and tell them, you know, "I don't have a period. I can't really walk and I could run before. My skin is a mess," you know, all these things. And they'd say, "Okay, but otherwise you're healthy."
In the fall of 2010, after months of frustration, pain, and unanswered questions,
Lisa's doctors decided to do an MRI as a last-ditch effort to solve her medical mysteries. And they did solve them. Sort of. The MRI revealed a large tumor on her pituitary gland. Pituitary tumors aren't actually that uncommon, but the size and nature of Lisa's tumor was cause for concern. She was referred to an endocrinologist who did a wider panel of blood work and finally determined that her growth hormones were, as Lisa says, way off the charts. The puzzle was starting to come together.
You know, I kind of felt vindicated and everyone finally believed me that there was an issue, because by that point it was my arms would go tingly at night. I was always very hot and everything. I just felt like I was in someone else's body. And I was about 50 pounds more than I had been just like 6 months prior to that. So it was pretty out of control. And obviously that was very challenging. So then we went to see the neurosurgeon, and we were in the neurosurgeon's office, and she asked me to bring photographs of me a few years prior and me then. And she barely looked at the pictures and said, oh yeah, absolutely, you have acromegaly.
Acromegaly is a hormone disorder in which your pituitary gland produces excess human growth hormone. It comes with a host of symptoms, many of which you heard Lisa describe. But it's most commonly associated with a gradual increase in bone size. People who are affected by it usually have enlarged hands and feet. Their jaws and brows start to protrude, and they may notice thickened facial features, like broader lips and tongues. But the gradual nature of these changes makes acromegaly hard to detect, and people often go years without a diagnosis, only noticing the bone size increase when they compare photos of what they used to look like with what they look like now. Lisa's neurosurgeon told her that the tumor needed to be removed as soon as possible.
Which I was pleased to hear that was happening, but also quite shocked actually at the speed at which this whole thing kind of happened, because it had been such a long, drawn out advocacy process. And then boom, neurosurgeon, we were in her office on Thursday and she said, let's do surgery on Monday. And it was a bit startling.
The pituitary gland normally hangs like a tiny balloon out of the base of the brain. In Lisa's case, the tumor had grown so much that it flattened the pituitary like a pancake, making it barely visible on the MRI. This explained all of Lisa's hormone issues and the corresponding symptoms, but it added to the complicated nature of her surgery.
I had the surgery on December 6th, 2010. Which is now forevermore called my rebirthday. And so I went for surgery that day, expecting to have maybe a 2 to 3 hour surgery and maybe a 2 to 3 day in the hospital. The surgery ended up taking about 6 hours because the tumor was wrapped around my carotid artery. So every time my surgeon tried to take a bit of it, it would bleed. And she was obviously very concerned about the impact that was going to have on my, future. Pituitary tumors are also very close to the optic nerve, so there's a risk of blindness associated with tampering up in that area. And so she had to meticulously, piece by piece by piece, remove this tumor from in and around my carotid artery. And so I was in surgery for 6 hours, my poor family out in the waiting room, not getting updates and not knowing what was happening. And I was single at the time, so I didn't have a partner who kind of was sharing that experience. And I think ultimately that contributed to a lot of the strength that developed out of this. And I'm kind of happy in some ways that I was on my own and that I had my family and it was our thing that we went through.
Lisa's surgery ended up being successful, but she wasn't out of the dark yet. Instead of 2 or 3 days, she spent a week and a half in the recovery unit. Lisa says that every complication that could possibly have occurred did.
Which was kind of at this point becoming a bit of a running joke in our family. Like, if it's going to happen to anyone, it's going to happen to you. And even my family doctor, she said, now, whenever I come with anything, and she says, well, it's very, very, very unlikely it could be X, but it's you. So we're going to check for X, Y, Z and see what happens here. And so I was in the bed for a really long time that week. I think I didn't walk till the 9th day, perhaps. And so as someone who uses movement and loves to run, it was deeply challenging to surrender to this experience. And My head obviously was in a lot of pain. I had to have a catheter in my nose to maintain the area so that there wasn't any damage. It was taped to my forehead and like flopping around in my hair, and my hair was in one big nest at this point. And my sister, I can remember her trying to like tease out my hair. And, you know, I mean, we've got some pretty, I mean, the pictures are funny now, but when you look at this catheter taped to someone's face, it's pretty intense.
Pretty intense seems like an understatement. Lisa developed diabetes insipidus, a sudden onset of diabetes generally caused by damage to the pituitary. It throws the balance of fluids in the body completely out of whack, resulting in extreme thirst and, subsequently, large amounts of diluted urine. In the space of 24 hours, Lisa consumed, and then expelled, over 25 liters of fluid. By the time she left the hospital, she weighed 25 pounds less than when she had arrived only 10 days prior. Which, she says, felt great. But the challenges were still far from over.
And then what happened was when they took the catheter out of my nose and I leaned forward, the cerebral spinal fluid started to drip out my nose, which meant that the area hadn't healed. And so my brain was exposed to the elements. So we had to do a spinal tap in my back and siphon it down the back to take the pressure off of the upper area and allow that spot to heal.
Amazingly, in spite of the physical horrors that she was experiencing, Lisa found a way to maintain her sense of humor throughout this entire ordeal.
One of the things that happened during that procedure was this very cute doctor came in to do the spinal tap, and he said to me, you know, you're very skinny in your back and this is probably going to hurt. And I was like, oh, thank you. That's the best thing that anyone has said to me this entire week. I remember him just looking at me like, what?
My lovely, delicate back.
Yeah, I was like, oh, yes, I know. Yeah. I know. Yes, it's probably, I hope it hurts a lot. Yeah. Oh, man. And so, I really did try to find humor as often as I could through all of this.
I was going to say, it sounds like you found a way to find a lot of humor in this situation.
Yes, yes.
I mean, good for you. I think sometimes that's out of necessity, right? Like it's...
Oh, yeah. It's
what else are you going to do?
Exactly. Like, I have a shtick around this whole thing, right. You know, because you can, it can either be horrific or you can make it, it can be humorous. It's both, right. But I prefer to capitalize on the humor part of it.
This sense of humor, even in dark situations, was a crucial component to Lisa's recovery and to the internal strength that she developed as a result. And she's had plenty of opportunities to put it to good use. Going back to early 2010, when she had first started noticing the symptoms of her condition, but before the tumor was discovered, Lisa reveals to me that her urethra prolapsed. The urethra is generally held in place by muscles and ligaments, but when those systems cease to function normally, like, for example, when excess growth hormone causes them to shift and grow, the urethra can protrude out of the body. This is what happened to Lisa. She had surgery to repair it, and figured the rest of the year would go more smoothly. But it was only a few months later that her tumor was discovered and removed. Once again, Lisa thought she was more or less in the clear following the second major surgery. But once again, she was wrong. Although the root source of her medical issues, the pituitary tumor, was gone, the effects on her body were to be much longer lasting. Lisa had three more surgeries in 2011, 2012, and 2013, for complications that she is convinced were related to the tumor, even if her doctors disagree.
It was definitely the cause of all my issues prior, and then it was issues post. Because the tumor caused so many problems for my body. Basically what it did was, because it was growth hormone, it was causing my whole body to be under pressure. So the fluid retention and then the strain on everything was because essentially it was growing. And so my body is under all this pressure, and that's what prolapses the urethra. And then it also formed some rectal fistulas. So then I had to have three rectal surgeries. But all these things kind of, they're all interconnected. Nobody in the medical field thinks that they are, though. They've all said to me, the urethral prolapse is separate from the pituitary tumor, which is separate from the rectal fistula, which I don't believe at all. I appreciate that they're medical professionals, but intuitively it makes no sense to me there has to be a correlation between these situations and these events. So really, my health decline started at the end of 2009 until February of 2013. It was really that whole time was in and out of surgery, in and out of doctor's offices, in and out of hospitals. And it was relentless. It was a hard time to be trusting that things would ever be better.
The thing that kept her going throughout the 4 years of turmoil was the belief that she would one day get healthy enough to return to running.
My goal was always to be back running again. So after every surgery, it was like, when I can run again, I know that I'm better. And every time I would go for surgery or every time I would go for a scan or a test or an MRI, anything, my running visualization was a huge instrumental part of my coping process. So
you have these health issues that are ongoing. You're a runner. You're someone who, as a runner, and you've talked about this, is in touch with your body pretty well and obviously sees your overall health and well-being as a priority in your life. I can imagine this would have been so disarming to have a situation where you had no control. How did that manifest? How did that change your outlook on your health and your well-being?
So the first thing I did was take control with food. When I was lying in when my urethra prolapsed, we ended up at emergency because we had no idea what was happening. I said to my mother, I need you to look at something, and I'm really sorry to be your, you know, late 20s daughter and asking you to look at my body. And, you know, she's my mom. So she did. And she said, I don't know what that is. We need to go to the hospital. No one knew what it was. Every doctor says, we've never seen this before. This happens in two kinds of populations and it's not in yours. It didn't make any sense to them. They tried to push it back in, that was their approach, which you can imagine is horrific. It was horrific. Eventually they let me get up and I went into the bathroom, and I remember this so clearly because this became what I do to this day, which was I just get really fierce eye contact with myself in the mirror and I just say, you're fine. Even when I'm not, and even when nothing is okay, I say it because I really believe in the power of what you say becomes what is real. And so if I say, this is horrible, you're dying, that's not gonna help move me through. So I get this fierce eye contact, I say, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine. And then I went back into the room and I said to my mom, I think I wanna be a vegan. Like, it was just something to do. And that is what I did. I went home from that hospital. I got obsessed with all of the hot vegan blogs and the raw food world. And because I had to do something active for myself, and I couldn't perpetually go to doctors and have them say, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know. And so I decided to become a raw vegan. I was strictly raw for about 9 months following that surgery, which is not easy to do, especially when you live in Canada and the seasons. Fortunately, it started in the summer, so I was able to capitalize on that. But that was kind of the only control I felt I could take. And it really did have a really positive impact on my health, for sure. Yeah. I could feel in the midst of all that was happening that I was doing something really good for myself.
What were some of the concrete changes that you noticed through that change in diet?
Yeah, so I started playing with the raw vegan diet after the prolapse surgery, but before we knew I had a tumor. So when I started eating that way, some of the weight came off. Some of my skin calmed down. Some of my joints hurt a little bit less. So it was helping my body. It was... What I realize now is that all of this stuff was competing. So the tumor was trying to put on weight, trying to hurt my joints, trying to destroy my skin. And the diet was fighting back and giving me a bit of reprieve. So in that summer before they found the tumor, when I was eating really clean and really healthy, I actually felt pretty good. It had changed how shitty I felt leading up to the prolapse and through that after the half marathon, and when I just, you know, should have been feeling really good and was feeling the complete opposite. So it did allow my body a bit of reprieve from what the tumor was doing to it. And then every time I had surgery, I always ate as clean as possible following every surgery because I healed much faster. And I know that that is true because my doctors were often really surprised at how quickly I was able to heal and come back from things after that.
Lisa sees food as medicine, not as a replacement to conventional Western medication, but as a supplement to it and as a vehicle for recovery. After all, we are what we eat. She talks about the stark contrast between the nourishment she was prioritizing for herself and the food that was provided to her by the hospital post-surgery.
I'm in the hospital and I've had this brain surgery and they're bringing me the hospital food with, you know, white bread and milk and, you know, stewed meats and things like this. And I refused to eat anything. My parents, I understand my privilege and how fortunate I am that my parents were able to come to the hospital to bring me food each day, to provide me with the salads and the smoothies and the juices that I needed. It pains me to no end that not all people have access to that kind of resource because you're at the mercy of what they give you. And I knew through my nutritional learning, not a education background, but just an interest background, that the building blocks I needed to heal were going to come from food. And so they even sent the nutritionist from the hospital to see me because I was labeled as a refusing to eat patient. And I explained to her as kindly as I could that I'm definitely not refusing to eat, but I'm definitely refusing to eat this. Again, I want to just locate myself in the privilege of being able to get to have those things. So my parents and my sister brought me lots of food. And so I was able to do that. Wow. So that was a huge part of after every surgery, eating that way. You know, you come out of rectal surgery and they offer you cheese and crackers. Like, excuse me, dairy and, you know, processed carbohydrates. That's not going to help someone who needs to have like their bowels working really nicely. That's not going to help me. So
it's this multi-layered thing I'm hearing you say. It's first and foremost, it sounded like the level of control that you could regain over your situation, over your health, over your autonomy. Mm-hmm. And then you're seeing all these really fantastic physical benefits, which I am sort of extrapolating would probably lead to some great mental benefits too. Have you continued eating raw and vegan since?
Nope. So what I did was just before the tumor was found, I had started making green smoothies for teachers at the school where I taught. So I made myself this little side hustle of carrying 8 to 10 green smoothies on the transit to my school every day and making a little note for the teachers about what the benefits are of what was in their smoothie and a little inspirational quote. And they started buying the smoothies. And so because I was eating raw, because I was eating vegan, I was at farmers markets a whole ton that summer. And I ended up purchasing a painting off the wall of a local raw food restaurant. And the artist ended up becoming my business partner in Earthen City. So that's how we met. We started the business before I had the surgery for the tumor. So the business had already been established. And since then, I've always eaten the way that Earthen City produces food. So it's all vegan. It's not all raw. It was when it started, but we do use cooked foods. Its mission has to do more with seasonality and local procurement. But I had been mainly vegan for many, many years. And my wife will roll her eyes when I blame her for this, but she's an extraordinary cook and she does all of the food for our home. And she doesn't cook vegan. She cooks extremely healthy and very varied and uses a lot of seasonal and local ingredients because that's a deep value of hers as well. But she creates food around everything that we have in Ontario and the food available to us. And so I eat everything now. Yeah. And sometimes I think to myself, oh, you know the like best way to eat, but that served a very specific purpose for me at the time. And I feel that I've got a really great balance in my diet and I know what to do when things are maybe going off the rails a bit. I could avoid all of that by only eating a certain way, but I've decided that the balance is more effective for me.
Lisa still treats her body gently and cautiously in certain ways, but she is finally, truly, otherwise healthy. And yes, she has made her return to running.
In terms of any like lasting physical impact, there isn't much. there's a certain level of, I think, sensitivity that I take to my body. So I try to just really listen to it in terms of the areas that did undergo surgery, to just pay attention, you know, is everything that's happened has a potential for happening again. So there's, it's not like something was wrong with a certain organ and that organ's gone. Everything is still there. And so potentially something could prolapse again. Something could form an issue again. A tumor could come back. So they're all things that could happen again. So the biggest thing I think I've decided in my life is to reduce the potential for causing problems. So the thing that comes to my mind most forefront is not wanting to ever carry a baby and not go through pregnancy and childbirth in my own body. And so I kind of decided that very quickly after the surgeries happened, that was something I wasn't willing to do to my body. No doctor per se said you shouldn't do this. They said that you are going to want to be cautious of the things that you do with your body, but they never specifically said that. And so I did really think, how am I going to become a parent? Because I didn't realize that I would meet someone with a uterus, and that's what happened with my wife. Then that just worked out really well, because now we have our son because she carried him. So really not wanting to go through pregnancy is the biggest choice I've made with regards to my body. In terms of the mental aspect of running and how all of this has really impacted my running, is that pain is very subjective, and my experience of pain is very different now. So a lot of the things that happened post-surgery from the brain tumor and post-rectal surgeries was involved an extraordinary amount of pain, very intense physical pain. And I don't know that I could do anything in running that could ever hurt that much. I could shatter something I don't want to say that nothing could happen that would hurt that much, but maybe what the right thing to say is that it puts pain in perspective. So when I'm out on a long run and it's getting hard, and you know, I'm 30K into a long training run and I don't want to do it anymore, and my body starts to feel sore and my mind says, well, this is hurting, why don't we stop? The sort of wiser mind cuts in and says, this is not pain, my friend. And it's nice, actually, to be able to tap into that, to use that as fuel for getting through the hard times in running.
Lisa put her newly increased pain threshold to test at last year's Squamish 50K, a challenging trail race in the mountains of BC and the longest race she had ever attempted.
And how was that?
Squamish was painful, but not ever in a way that made me want to quit or stop or give up. What I try to do is, whenever something gets rough or painful in a run or a race, is use something from my past or a mantra to move through it. And so Squamish, I am really good at climbing uphill. I'm so bad at downhill running, which trail runners, they love to bomb that downhill, right? But I don't have that. I think one of the things I do have is I'm not sort of reckless with my body, because I worry about it still. And not to say that those that bomb the down are reckless, but there's an abandon that people can run with, and I don't quite run with that abandon. Going down at Squamish is really painful. It's a really long process. It takes a long time to climb up Galactic, but it takes a really long time to come down it as well. And what I decided was that every time I was feeling something negative in my mind, or pain, or something was shitty, I would say joy right afterwards. So and that kind of became my word of the race. And so I was coming out of Quest and feeling like $1 million, and then I started the next climb and instantly I basically grind to a halt and feel so tired and feel like this is unsurmountable. And so then I'll just go, this is really shitty, joy, and then keep going. And then, I'm so bad at downhill, joy, you know, I don't want to go any further, joy. So it was a bit cheesy, but I was saying joy out loud a lot on the race, and kind of used that as my word. And because it worked so beautifully, I've tried to find other words and other little short phrases to use over and over through different kinds of running.
Lisa got a new lease on life. And after everything she's been through, her biggest takeaway is that she wants to grab that life and run with it. Because, quite simply, she can.
I am so aware that I can do this because I know very acutely what it feels like to not be able to do it. And so when you're lying in a hospital bed or you're recovering for weeks on end or months on end and you can't do something, you become so keenly aware of what it is to be able to do it. And so at the back door, very recently, I just stuck up on the back door, it just says, because you can. And it's just where I come in from my run and hang up all my stuff so that my wife doesn't get mad that I leave my stuff all over the house. So I just stuck it up the other day. And that's the thing around what I said earlier about is where what you say is what becomes. So if I say this is too hard, or I'm not good enough, or there's no way I can do this, or I don't know if I can do this, I don't really say those things. The quiet voice in my head is a really positive one. And I think that I learned early on that what you believe about yourself is what is. And so it's hard to just, you know, some people would say, well, I have, you know, I don't have the best mental health. I don't have the strongest inner voice. You know, how do you change that? I don't know how you change it. I don't think it's as simple as just we'll try to change it. But whenever I do have friends who do sort of tend to have a mental tape that's kind of negative, I say the positive one, and until it's like, just say it till it's awkward, say it till it's hurts. Just, yeah. You know, it's worth trying. Yeah. Yeah. And the power of that is huge. You know, conversely, I'm also really not afraid to fail. Like, it doesn't matter to me if I don't achieve something specific. I was fully prepared to not finish Squamish, and I would have been very disappointed, certainly. But I've kind of come to a place where I think if you've never failed at anything, maybe you haven't pushed yourself far enough. And that doesn't mean we should all be going out and grinding ourselves into the ground and, you know, breaking a leg trying to do some crazy trail race that we're not ready for. But it's finding that your own line and just thinking, well, let's try to cross it. Mm-hmm. And what's the worst thing that could happen is maybe you just don't get over it. Mm-hmm. And so this year I've signed up for a 50 miler. It's way out of my league, but then also, what does that even mean? If I don't do it, then, you know, there's a bunch of things like, okay, well, if you do a 50 miler and say you only made it halfway, well, you just ran a trail marathon. That's pretty sweet. What if you only make it, you know, a quarter of the way? Wow, that's a really great trail half marathon, you know? And I just know that when you go after big things, there's too much to learn, that what you can lose is pales in comparison to what you can learn. So I think it's really fun to push yourself to the edge and fun to see what's on the other side, and really worth it because for me, the excavation, the unearthing of myself has come through all of these things.
How has that, and I call it taking smart risks, right? Because it's like, you're right, you don't need to go off and do silly things that are going to do more damage than good, but taking risks within parameters that are educated and reasonable, how has that manifested in your life as a business owner? That risk-taking, that pushing boundaries, that doing things you didn't know you could necessarily do?
Yeah, I think when life isn't going the way that you anticipated it to go, it throws a wrench into things. You know, I really had a vision for my life. I was really excited to be a teacher. I imagined it being a lifelong career. I was fully prepared to marry the man that I was engaged to, that we bought our house with. That was the plan. And when he left and I was now living in this house on my own and my health was all of a sudden plummeting, you know, you don't know what's real or what you can trust anymore. And so when we met, my business partner had also gone through something similar, not a health experience, but a relationship experience. And we were both just kind of raw and a bit open, you know? And so I don't think that what Earth and City became could have come from a strategic plan and a market need. And, you know, that kind of thing. It was born out of really the necessity of life for two people who were kind of floundering, and to anchor ourselves in something as nourishing as food and as inspirational as the season and our province was pretty exciting. And so I think in business, the way that we have gone about it is you're taking risks without even realizing. So you all of a sudden you're sort of playing business, and then now you have orders and you have customers, and then you have an employee, and you're still playing business. And for us, you know, we've always taken really calculated risks. So we aren't the type of people who've gone out and gotten, you know, a $200,000 loan to make some things happen. We basically put $50 each in and bought groceries to make the first round of food, and then sold that food, and then that money became the, you know, so there are much, much smarter business people than I will ever be, who would create it in a way that would probably have it generating a whole lot of income. That's not what it is. But we measure success in really different ways.
What does that look like?
I think for us, it's having people who enjoy working there. It's contributing to our local community. We are really visible. We go to 8 weekly farmers markets in the summertime, so we're all over the city. And I know that our impact is probably more than we've realized in terms of what it means for people who do eat in this very specific way. I'm actually less of a risk taker in business than I am in life. Basically, when they took out that tumor on December 6, 2010, which I told you was my rebirth day, I see life as gravy now. So it really does feel like extra. And it just feels like I had this life up until I was 28 years old. And if that had been all I got, and it ended that day, then, I mean, I wouldn't be able to say, like, it was okay, but I sort of feel like, okay, you know, what I had done before that was pretty great. I had a great life, I had a great family, great friends, I had a great career, I had started this business, like, I did a lot of great stuff. And now, this next phase just feels like a bonus life that I'm living. And so why not try weird things? Why not try crazy things? Why not say yes to love that doesn't look like you thought it was gonna look like? Why not say yes to family structure that isn't what you anticipated? Why not say yes to 50K in the mountains of BC when you don't even know what you're doing? Who cares, kind of, you know? And so, great, let's come be on a podcast. Maybe I'll try to write a book. You know, I there's a local musician I follow who's like looking for people to be in his music video. I'm like, me! You know, I'm just the kind of person who wants to just say yes to things because, you know, what else am I going to do?
Lisa has been through more adversity in the last decade than many of us will experience in our lifetime. But in spite of this, or maybe because of it, her positivity is infectious. When you meet her, you feel it right away. I asked Lisa about this, about the contagious nature of her optimism and energy, and about how she's sharing it with her running community. We'll end today's show with part of our conversation about the concept of inspiration.
I've had a chance to share this story in a couple of platforms, and small platforms, but, you know, I see the impact that it has, and people, you know, they like hearing these stories, and people do take things from them. And it's taken me a while to sort of be comfortable with that inspirational piece of things. I'm always just like, well, even when you ask me to come, I'm like, oh, but Kate, I'm just regular person, you know?
But I think that's what's inspiring about it. Like, I don't think you need to And that's why, you know, on this show, I'm super lucky because I get to interview a bunch of my friends, my elite friends who have like won international medals. And then I get to interview people who will never be on an Olympic start line. And there's no difference in the level of inspiration. And in fact, I think sometimes the relatability of someone who, I mean, you say you're just a regular person, but you're, I mean, I don't even know what that means.
Right.
You're a person who's been through some extraordinary circumstances that were nothing to do with you. They were going to happen to you one way or the other. And here's how you've managed that. And just like pain is so subjective, I think like our experiences are also so subjective. Ooh. And so someone who has never been through the surgeries that you've been through will draw a lot from what you're saying just because they've gone through something that's been tough for them. And now they're looking for a source of strength. And yeah,
definitely.
So I think there's a lot of value in that.
You know, everybody has their hard. And so,
exactly.
You know, it's not, we're not in a competition for adversity.
Right. Yeah. And that there is so much value in talking with people who have been through adversity that looks nothing like yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because maybe they can say something that will trigger something in the way that you view your circumstance that will be beneficial.
Yeah, totally.
You've talked about the community building aspect and community engagement aspect of your business and how that's a real important value for yourself and your business partner. Do you see any parallels between that and the community aspect of running?
Yeah. I mean, I think my sort of constraints have led me to mostly be a solo runner because I do get up at 4:30 to do my runs now that I'm teaching again. But I love the community aspect of running. I'm on the trail crew with the Five Peaks team, and it's my second year. This season will be my second year as one of the ambassadors for Five Peaks. And finding Five Peaks changed my entire running life. And I'd never even heard of Five Peaks. I didn't really know a lot about trail running as a specific sport. Mm-hmm. And I just had such a blast. Finding Five Peaks and finding the trail was like finding this whole new world for me in running. And the community is so tight and so welcoming and so encouraging. And there's a vibe to trail running that's so casual, but also competitive for those who want it to be. But there's space for everyone. There's such a transformative experience out in the trails, for sure. I mean, I ran my very first trail race less than 2 years ago, and then I've already done Squamish 50K. You know, that shows you the progression. It can be quite rapid, and it's really Gary Robbins' fault and Ethan Newberry's fault for Where Dreams Go to Die, but I was like, I want my dreams to die. So then I wanted to go run in the mountains and, you know, shatter some dreams or maybe make them come true. I had practiced my finish line face in the mirror a lot for Squamish because I wanted it to be this, you know, this balance of like grit and like emotion. And so sometimes I would practice like putting my arms in the air and being like with this roar. And then sometimes I thought like maybe I'll just, you know, come running across with like jazz hands. But the only thing I knew is that I wanted them to like I wanted my wife to hand me our son because he was 18 months at the time. And I had this vision, right? Because you see like some of these elite athletes and they hoist their kids up at the end and it's the best feel good moment ever. And I started crying about 2K before the finish line. Like the emotions just overcame me and I couldn't believe that it was actually going to happen. And I was going to get my Gary Robbins hug and I'm coming into the finish line and I'm like sort of starting to hyperventilate. And I realize quickly like, oh, I'm not going to be able to do my finish line face. But I'm too overcome with like this crying thing that's starting to happen. And so I cross the line and I like very shakily hug Gary. There's no like roar. There's no like arms in the air and I'm a bit shaky and I hug him and then my wife hands me our son and he wants nothing to do with me. He's immediately trying to get out of my arms back to her. I can't even like really hoist him up. And so my favorite picture is Gary looking like, what is happening here? And me trying to talk to everybody and my son just reaching out of the frame of the picture to my wife. And that's real, right? That is real. I could try to orchestrate the best finish I could imagine, but real life. And it's my favorite picture because it's awesome. It's really real. But that community is really what trail running feels like to me. It's just people out there for each other, cheering each other. It was just such a great experience. I'm going back to Squamish to volunteer in August because I just want to give back to them because of what they gave me. And I get to be one of those friendly faces that people were for me to say, you're welcome here, you're included, you're part of this. Like, let's go have fun.
Well, we've all been pushed around from here and out to the school ground, left our hearts in the lost and found, 'cause we've all been pushed around.
By the way, that photo Lisa's talking about at the end of Squamish can be found on our website, as Ken links to her business, Earth and City. Thank you so much to Lisa Sweetman for sharing her story with us today. If you were inspired by this episode, and honestly, how could you not be, pick up the latest print edition of Canadian Running Magazine, featuring many more stories of inspiring members of the running community on newsstands now. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Shakeout Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again soon.
Well, we've all been